Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city in quite some detail, explaining the ins and outs of life in this great metropolis, the ongoing local news of the community by the Thames, and how the city was impacted by England's political events and how in turn it impacted upon the rest of the country and eventually the world. We have reached chapter 86 in the story, covering the years 1216 until 1219. And the situation in London was pretty extraordinary. London had transformed a lot in the last few years, and only a couple of years ago, it had seen itself become the principal city in a political debate in England, engaged in negotiations with King John over protecting the rights of the city and of noble barons. Now, well, it just so happened that right now is the capital of a campaign to place the heir of the throne of France, a man called Prince Louis, to take the throne of England. London and the rebels against the king had invited Louis to come to England, and in St. Paul's they had proclaimed him king of all the land. A war obviously followed, and the war was seemingly going their way. And then King John died, and the throne passed to his son Henry. It's easy to think that Henry III taking the throne and ruling England was a foregone conclusion. We know he goes on to become Henry III, so we're inclined to believe his victory was inevitable. But it was far from that. He was just 9 years old when he took the throne, and his father's regime was on the back foot mostly compared to that of the French claimant to the throne. For those alive at the time, this conclusion was far from set. And so, let's bring this story to an end. An ending that was to see history repeat itself. Once upon a time, London had supported a king called Edmund, and the rest of the country had supported a man called Canute, and London had been placed under siege. Amazingly enough, history was kind of, sort of, about to repeat itself. Welcome then to chapter 83 of The Story of London, a king from their own land. Now, it must be said that even in the earliest days of his regime, the young boy, Henry III, had certain things going for him, circumstances beyond his control that aided his cause significantly. The first was his relationship with the church. His father had begged the Pope to take England and his son under their wing before he died, and at the boy's coronation, he had been told to do homage to the papacy, and so he had. And then, only 4 days after his coronation, the young child swore to go on crusade, the ritual of taking the cross. Now, this kid had no intention of actually going to the Holy Land, but as the Peterborough Chronicle puts it, he did it, quote, for the greater protection of himself and his kingdom, unquote. This, combined with his young age, made the new Pope, Pope Honorius, feel that he could and should and would do anything to protect this young man and his claim to the English throne. He ordered the papal legate to England, a man called Guala, to do whatever needed to be done, without question, in order to secure for the boy his kingdom. This serious support from the papacy added an air of legitimacy to the young kid's regime. Added to this, arguably the most important thing Henry III had going for him was the man chosen to become his regent, William Marshall. We've met William Marshall before in The Story of London. All the way back in chapter 75, it had been this man whom King Richard I had sent over to liberate his mother, Queen Eleanor of Aquitaine, from her incarceration in Winchester. He was still kicking around, you see. And he was one hell of an interesting character. William Marshall derived his surname from the office of Marshal of the Royal Household, which had been a hereditary position in his family since at least the reign of Henry I. The lands owned by his family were not particularly large, and William himself had been a younger son of the dynasty, and therefore had been forced to make his own way in the world. But he'd made a heck of an impression. He had served at the courts of all the Angevin kings with great bravery and skill, and had gained from Prince Richard his most magnificent reward, the marriage to the heiress of Chepstow in Wales, Leinster in Ireland, and Longueville in Normandy, and later on, King John had added to his estates by granting him Pembroke in Wales. As our story picks up, however, he is an older man, probably as late as his 70s, but was definitely keen of mind and was remarkably physically active. What surprises many was William Marshall's relationship with the previous king, John. It was clear that Marshall personally deeply disliked the king, and while he had remained loyal to him, there was a certain ambiguity in William Marshall's actions towards the late king. For example, back in 1204, when Normandy had fallen to the French king, William Marshall had done homage to King Philip of France in order to keep his lands in Longueville, and thus, alone almost of all the English barons, he actually retained his Norman lands. Marshall would have been within his rights to have defected to the side of Prince Louis because of that oath to his father, but he had not gone over to the side of the French. And as much as he disliked John, the shame of deserting the dynasty he had sworn loyalty to and spent his entire life serving seems to have been arguably the most important consideration in his choices, even if he did allow himself some wriggle room by conspiring to have his eldest son rebel against the regime while he remained loyal, you know, just in case. Yet it wasn't just his fidelity to the Angevin dynasty that made him so ideal for the choice of regent. He was praised far and wide as being a knight without equal. He had earned the title of the greatest knight in the world on many a tournament field, but his prowess was not limited to ceremonial mock battles. As one historian put it, William Marshall, quote, had a shrewd head for the business of war, unquote. He was realistic and bold, understood logistics as well as siegecraft. He was, even in his advancing years, the most competent of the young king's possible military leaders. And given that the young king was taking the throne when his kingdom was in a state of war, Marshall was really one of only two real candidates for the job of holding the title of regent of the boy king. The other at the time was the Earl of Chester, a man who remained loyal also to the dynasty and was in many ways significantly richer than Marshall. Now, the Earl of Chester was rather problematic and ambitious. For example, he turned up to the young king's camp the day after the coronation and his people complained that the ceremony should have been delayed until the Earl arrived, because he's that important. The Earl, however, for all his pride, did recognise the old man's military chops, and he urged William to accept control of the king and the kingdom. And finally, as an icing on the cake, the papal legate promised the old man remission and pardon of all his sins if he took up the burden of becoming the regent of England. On the night of October 29th, 1216, having accepted control of the government, William Marshall withdrew to his chambers and considered the geopolitical situation with his closest advisers. It appeared as if Prince Louis held all the cards. One of his advisers supposedly suggested young Henry should be taken abroad to Ireland, where the rebels' cause had no success in gaining any support in the lands held by the English knights over there. But William Marshall apparently said, with his stoic intensity, how he would personally carry the king on his shoulders from island to island and from land to land. Quote, I will never desert him, even if I have to beg my bread, unquote. Yet, for all his stubbornness, even William Marshall had to accept that the situation for the young king was grim. When King John died, the holders of 97 baronies were in revolt against him, against only 36 who were still loyal. and of the 27 greater baronies, only 8 remained loyal to the regime of the young king. Prince Louis controlled London and virtually the whole of the eastern half of England. He was in alliance with Alexander, the King of Scotland, and with Llywelyn, the Prince of North Wales. Yet there was reasons to hope still. If Louis had more baronial support, he had virtually no ecclesiastical support. The excommunications launched by the Pope against him and his supporters had seen to that. Yes, sure, in London, Louis's clerks, Simon Langton, Gervase of Heybridge, Elias of Dereham, and Robert de Saint-Germain were busy preaching and thundering that the excommunications were invalid and extolling Londoners to hold firm in their support of their French prince. But the highest ranking ecclesiastical post held between any of them was the Dean of St. Paul's, to which Gervase had a doubtful claim for that even in the first place. No bishop or higher supported the French prince across the land. But even with this, it begs the question, how could William Marshall fight back? Well, his first decision was to primarily use politics. And in this, William showed himself to be an incredibly pragmatic and shrewd man. He needed as many barons as possible back into the royal fold. And he started doing this by having the young king bypass much of his father's baggage. At his behest, the young king sent out a royal letter wherein it had him saying, quote, "We hear that a quarrel arose between our father and certain nobles of the kingdom. We wish to remove it forever, since it has nothing to do with us," unquote. By offering a blank slate like this, a willingness to listen to individual grievances, Marshall had the boy simply shrug off much of the baggage that his father had laid upon him. And by December 1216, 18 rebels had been sent letters giving them safe conducts to come speak with the king, or William Marshall, maybe swap sides. And Marshall had also reissued the Grand Royal Charter of Liberties, the Magna Carta, now as a working document, with the strong limits on the king the Committee of 25 had insisted upon removed. But this ultimately took the grand cause away from the rebel side. Louis and his supporters could no longer claim to be working on behalf of the Magna Carta. The new king was doing that. However, despite these excellent moves and despite there being some defections, these defections were not profound. Louis and his city of London had reasons to feel emboldened still. While the royalists had gained some returns, no one significant had returned their allegiance to the royalist cause. And by February 1217, it seemed as if the military situation was turning in Louis' benefit. The fighting had carried on right through the winter, with Louis opening sieges at Hertford Castle, which he took in early December, and then Buckhamsted Castle, which he took on the 20th of December. After that castle fell, a Christmas truce was established, and we expired round about, early January 1217. Peace talks supposedly tried to begin on January the 13th between William Marshall and Prince Louis, but the English supporters of the French prince refused to countenance any suggestion of peace. A new truce was agreed upon, but the momentum of war was clearly swinging London's way, and to get that new truce, the royalists had to agree to the surrender of the castles of Headingham, Orford, Norwich and Colchester. It was this flush of success that convinced Prince Louis to temporarily abandon London to return to France to gather up reinforcements. And despite an attempt to blockade his fleet, the French broke the blockade and Louis was able to get back to France. The regime of the king returned to matters political since it was getting nowhere military. And that spring, it resulted in large-scale defections from Prince Louis' cause over in the West Country. And the young king's forces began to take castles, by April holding Rochester, Southampton and Porchester. You see, for all of his success on the field, with Louis not there, there seems to have been a splintering of his support in England. Why? Well, a writer in Dunstable at the time said the reason was, quote, "The French have become arrogant, repulsed the nobles of England from their councils, began to call them traitors, and retained the castles which they took for themselves, and did not restore their rights to the English," unquote. And another writer also said that both rich and poor across England had begun to take up the cause to fight against Louis, quote, "preferring to have a king from their own land rather than from a foreign," unquote. These explanations, however, are just propaganda. Given that the start of John's problems had been his failure to retain the lands he ruled in France, given that Normandy had been the geopolitical centre of England for over 150 years, given the language spoken by most of these nobles was not English, this really wasn't a French v English campaign. It was always nobles of French origin versus other nobles of French origin. What really was at the heart of it were nobles of French origin who were mostly based in England and followed Prince Louis, and their rivalries with nobles of French origin who were mostly based in France and who followed Prince Louis, and the basic fact that the two sides were not getting on. The debate about dividing influence and possessions between his English-based and French-based followers was causing resentment, and the English ones had the option of going, "Right then, if you won't give me what I want, I'm going to play for the other side." The momentum of the war swung back towards the king, and this, added with the growing strength of young Henry's position, seemed to have invigorated his forces. The royalists marched out. However, when Louis returned to London in April 1217 to great acclaim, he equally reinvigorated his campaign. And the Londoners no doubt realised that the return of this charismatic prince and his energy at persecuting the war again would turn the tide, and so it seemed. Instantly upon Louis's return, William Marshall and the Earl of Chester, both conducting their own campaigns, withdrew their forces immediately, fearing their divided armies would be no match for Louis's main army. But Prince Louis also had to divide his forces. He wanted to surge north to take the royalist garrisons, but did not feel comfortable with the bloody town of Dover still holding out against him. So, by May the 12th, he restarted the siege of Dover and sent his forces north to help besiege Lincoln. And at this point, William Marshall's great knowledge of warfare came to full fruition with the most important strategic decision of his life. William Marshall ordered the royalist forces to unite and to march to Lincoln. William Marshall was looking for a battle. Now, only a few years before this, the entire geopolitical campaign of King John to reclaim his lands in France had fallen apart at the single Battle of Bouvines. Large-scale battles at the time were rare and had been for quite a while. As I described when talking about the anarchy between chapters 62 and 68, battles were high risk as they often could be all or nothing affairs. The Battle of Bouvines had proven that. John had lost his possession of Anjou and the Holy Roman Emperor Otto had fallen from power based on the outcome of that single battle. But what, for ever reason, the royalists had decided to seek a battle at Lincoln. And the situation they marched into was really complicated. The castle of Lincoln was held by royalists, and it was under siege by the forces of Prince Louis, who were now based in the town that surrounded the castle, and the town had walls around it, which protected them from the outside. And then the royalist army pulled up outside to besiege the town, which was besieging the castle. Strangely enough, the rebels seemed to be up for a battle as well, and they marched out to meet the royalist army, led by William Fitzwalter, the firebrand leader of this entire rebellion. But FitzWalter was no longer the Marshal of the Army of God. He was just a leading English baron in the cause of Prince Louis now. And the French commanders of this force ordered the rebel army back behind the walls. They preferred to have a siege. And for their part, the Royalists discovered a way into Lincoln, and after many brave deeds, succeeded in taking the town and capturing the rebel force leaders by the score. It was, like Bouvines, a tremendous victory and an instant blow to Louis's chances, a significant one. And for London? For the second time, the town of Lincoln had seen the ruination of the city's plans. King Stephen, champion of the city, had been captured at the Battle of Lincoln during the anarchy, as I mentioned in chapter 63. And now FitzWalter, the vintner and noble, their new champion, had also been captured at Lincoln. London could well be forgiven for hating that bloody little town. Instantly, the victors debated what to do next. Some urged they should march to relieve Dover, but others, they advocated that now they should march on rebellious London. William Marshall, however, urged caution. He said everyone should take the time to arrange the ransoms of their noble prisoners and to allow time be their ally in this. It was sensible and good advice, because it becomes apparent that Louis knew that with that battle, he was done. It was on the 25th of May at Dover when he heard the news of the disaster in Lincoln. Instantly, the French prince abandoned his siege, returned to London, and opened negotiations with the Royalist side. Now, negotiations for peace were opened under papal auspices, and on June the 13th, the delegates from the two sides actually almost reached an agreement. Louis would release his English supporters from all oaths of homage and fealty to him, and he would restore the lands he'd taken. In return, his followers were to be absolved from their sentences of excommunication and recover their own lands and possessions, and all prisoners taken after Louis' first arrival and all who'd been his supporters before, they were to be released, and their ransoms only paid up in instalments until the date of the finalisation of the peace process. Above all, Magna Carta was also to be an integral part of the settlement. Louis's adherents were then to enjoy, quote, all liberties and customs of the Kingdom of England, unquote. They were also to come out of this under the blessings of the Magna Carta. To get these concessions, Prince Louis showed commendable loyalty to his English supporters. But when talks broke down on June 15th, within a week, over 60 of these English supporters had swapped sides and pledged themselves to the new young king. The ship of London's great rebellion was sinking, and Prince Louis, facing this situation and the reality of it, moved his residence from the home of the Bishop of London, where he'd been staying this whole time, and he moved in to the Tower of London. The end game had begun. The papal legate urged William Marshall again to march upon London and place it under siege, but again Marshall delayed. I can see his point. I mean, why take the risk? He had his great victory at Lincoln. And to this great land victory soon came a naval one. You see, the prince's supporters back in France still had one last card to play. A new fleet was sent from Calais with men and the much-needed siege engines. If they could land and deploy, Louis could get a fresh burst of life. But in one of the earliest examples of a great English naval victory, the English fleet, using cunning tactics, seemed to sail past the French ships, then used the weather to come up behind them, and captured several of the French fleet, including their main flagship. The victory at the Battle of Sandwich really was the death knell for Prince Louis' campaign. When the prince heard the news of this defeat, on the evening of Saturday, the 26th of August, 1217, he briefly went mad with rage and grief, and then, quote, destitute of present aid and despairing of the future, unquote, he sued for peace. Even now, The new peace talks spluttered in fits and starts, beginning on Monday the 28th of August. They were going too slow. William Marshall finally decided a show of force was needed, and he moved his forces up and blockaded London by river and by land. It wasn't quite an armed siege, but for the Londoners, as they looked out from their walls, it clearly seemed as if the might of the kingdom waited there for their inevitable surrender. Sign the paper, London. Sign it, or else. On September the 11th, after hearing terms of surrender and after listening to the advice of the Londoners, his most constant champions, Prince Louis agreed to meet formally with the opposing side. That happened the next day. Louis was taken by boat to an island on the Thames near Kingston, and there he met Legate Gwala, the regent William Marshall, the young King Henry and his mummy, and formally agreed to the peace. There were still, even now, a few minor hiccups, and somewhere along the way, the Escavenge of London returned their constancy and showed their loyalty they had always displayed towards Prince Louis by paying him about £10,000 for his troubles. And on September the 20th, 1217, across the river at Lambeth, this treaty was ratified by a larger and more formal assembly than what had gathered on that island. And 3 days later, Prince Louis began his journey back to France. It was done. And London faced the inevitable retribution. Only that inevitable retribution? It never came. There was no retribution. Maybe it was because William Marshall was a pragmatist and the state of England right now was precarious. After all, the nation had basically just descended into utter chaos over the last few years. As a regime, they didn't have enough political capital to begin a campaign against the former rebels. Or maybe it was because the bedrock of the young king's rule now was the, you know, newly reissued and refashioned Magna Carta. And awkwardly, many of the rebels and London itself had been the birthplace of the Magna Carta. So, you know, you couldn't really go after it. Or maybe Prince Louis had negotiated bloody well in those final talks, gaining clemency in return for his leaving the kingdom. It could have been all of those reasons. But whatever the reason, London and the leaders of this grand rebellion did not face retribution or revenge upon them. As the process of settlement got underway, a great council assembled at Westminster, remaining in session from the 21st of October until around the 18th of November. All the major former rebel leaders, including Robert Fitzwalter and Gilbert de Clare and others, all attended. And during this council, London was actually full of former rebels, quote, doing fealty and homage to the king, unquote, as the Barnwell analyst put it, making out new charters of faithful service. Obviously on pains of disinheritance if they didn't, but they also obtained writs of forgiveness from the Chancery. They were all basically forgiven. And this entire thing seems to have been swept somewhat under the nearest royal carpet. The war was over. England needed to be rebuilt. And London? London escaped unscathed. And for me, the final proof of that, Serio the Mercer, one of the great instigators of London's part in this rebellion, simply became mayor again and held the position until 1221. And things returned to how they'd been before the passions of this nation had been so inflamed. Way, way back in chapter 52, when I ended book 2 of the story of London, I picked the year 1086, and I picked that date because of the nature of the economic contraction of London, and I said it was representative of the final demise of the much overlooked role the city had played as a significant European trade port previous to that date. But in calling book three of the story of London The Dark Age, I've tried over the last 33 chapters to show how extreme the situation in London had become over this era. This was an age of great geopolitical instability for the city. And it stretched as it did from the reign of William II, William Rufus, to now the beginning of the reign of Henry III. It was an era where affairs in Normandy had dictated the political fortunes of the English throne. An era of the Crusades, which were never a faraway thing, but whose actions changed the lives of many in the city. The Dark Age had seen a new London emerge. It retained many elements of older times, but also many new ones. It was a city where the Eshkevins, the oligarchs of London, had, during this era, come into their own. Theirs had been a struggle based on simply gaining power. Buoyed up by the examples of the pedestrians across the rest of Europe and inspired by Rouen, London had gained growing legal power via careful concessions from new regimes, as I covered back in chapter 77. Their support of Henry I had gained them little until he needed people to support his daughter Matilda, and thus they gained Henry's new charter. And then when Stephen turned up, they gained commune status from him for their support. And then later, when Richard needed funds, they had bought their liberties and created the mayoral position. Slowly, you see, during this Dark Age, the power of these oligarchs grow. But the Dark Age also saw the first flowerings of London's internal politics. The quasi-religious whistleblowing campaign of William FitzOsbert had come close to articulating the first groundswell of opposition towards the rich oligarchs of London, which I covered in chapter 79. But while that protest had failed, the idea of political strife within London had remained. And we may see here the first shades of division that emerged in the city, as we covered with the rise of the radical reactionary Mercer faction, who ordered knights to surge into the city and arrest their political opposition from within the residence. Now, these factions in London were based on ongoing political discussions, but the principal driver of all politics in the city was cash generation and economic conditions. Adulterine guilds like the Mercers, the Pepperers, and the Goldsmiths represented the highest echelons of the city, but there also included more humble crafts, bakers, for example. We'd also seen, back in chapter 68, during this era, the emergence of London-based local moneylenders, inspired by exemplars from the Flemish lands. These were Christian men who quietly charged interest on loans. And we've seen how the wealth they would generate would translate them from positions of authority and wealth in London to positions of respectability and power elsewhere, the best example being, of course, Gervase of Cornhill. To these London moneylenders had been added two outsiders. The first was London's Jewish community. Now, they had existed since possibly the time of William I, but they really emerged here in the Dark Age, in the wake of the First Crusade. That pogrom against the Jews of Rouen that took place as the Duke of Normandy prepared to leave on the First Crusade, just after he'd mortgaged the duchy to his brother William II, had created ideal circumstances for members of that community and others to migrate and move across the Channel to relatively safer London. And here the Jews had thrived, developing community just off Cheapside and becoming important to the growing financial markets of the city, with relatively easy credit being supplied by them to both the Crown and also to a score of smaller customers. And finally, to them had been added the first bankers of London, the Knights of the Templar, whose large wall compound flourished to the west of the city. These three groups, as I covered in chapter 68, had injected huge amounts of liquidity into the London economy, which had allowed the city to become the principal money pit of the realm. And all these things had driven internal politics and London's importance to the kingdom during the Dark Age. And then you couple all of this with the later growth in size, scale and scope of the operation of the King's Exchequer, really starting in the reign of Henry II. The sacred legal duties of royalty were becoming functionary duties of clerks and lawyers, and this growth, based as it was in Westminster and London's proximity to there, all came together with everything else I've said to create breeding conditions where London had become significantly more important during this dark age. But crucially, it had not been ready for these changes. It had not been prepared for the changes this brought. And as the population grew and the nature of the city and the region around it changed, so London had changed. And if we go back to that first pogrom against the Jews during the coronation celebrations of Richard I, for me that revealed the true extent of the growing nature of changes and new divisions within London. I mean, think about what we've seen during this dark age. We've seen the Tower of London besieged by forces from within the city of London itself. We'd seen passionate crowds of Londoners call the Archbishop of Canterbury a murderer and turn their own civic leaders into martyrs. We'd seen troops sent by London's rich kick down the doors of other Londoners. We'd seen the authorities be willing to set fire to churches to get to their political opponents. And we'd seen attacks upon Jews and indifference to wild packs of dogs attacking locals. The city had survived two terrible fires, the horrific Great Fire of Southwark and the earlier Pentecost Fire. It had survived extremely bad weather, pandemics and famine. It had risen in power. London had supported King Stephen of England first and most loyally, and this rise in power also showed the city was willing to turn against the rest of the nation. They had driven out the Empress Matilda and fomented rebellion and stood against her grandson King John. It was becoming a fulcrum where the almost nobles of London, in the simple process of going about their lives, could also change the course of history. Londoners had wrecked Winchester during this era. Twice events in Lincoln had ruined London's political plans during this era. The city had played host to noble potentates and great leaders, but it remained a series of small wards linked by the power of the aldermanic court, the hustings, and they had to clean up the shit on a regular basis. It had seen one of its three castles, Baynard, torn down out of spite, and three rulers, Stephen, John, and later Prince Louis, used the Tower of London as a bastion of last resort to feel safe in. But the city had changed and was changing. And with the rise of the boy king Henry III, it was about to change more. The dynamic of the city of London had altered forever. The one true lasting legacy of the failed attempt by the city to hoist Prince Louis of France upon the throne of England was really the true severance of Normandy from England. The geopolitical centre of the land was now firmly to be somewhere on the island. For the first time since William the Conqueror stepped foot on the shingles of Pevensey Bay. And where was that centre to become? A new bud of the ruling dynasty, the majestic Plantagenets, was sitting upon the throne. And we now enter a new age. Book 4 of The Story of London. The era of the Winter Kings. Because London is about to face all new issues and new problems. Thank you for listening. And I honestly hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you've been listening regularly, that you still continue to enjoy this long and somewhat over-detailed series. The Story of London can only exist due to listener support. And I'd like to gratefully thank my supporters, you few, you brave few, who kept us going for another month. If you do find this podcast entertaining, and if you feel you can help, you can support it via the membership page over on the Buy Me a Coffee site, or if you don't want to support with regular donations, you can make a one-off contribution there. And if you don't have the funds, or you just don't fancy giving cash for a podcast, I fully understand that, then I humbly ask if you could leave a 5-star like or a positive review, because these things impress the algorithms that actually regulate how much attention a podcast gets. I'll be back for book 4 of The Story of London. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Saul saying thank you. Bye.
Thank you.